You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with MLB.com Nationals reporter Jamal Collier. We're continuing our way around the roster, really, as we get ready for spring training 2017. A new home, of course, for the Nationals coming up in spring training. We'll talk about that at some point here on the podcast as well, Jamal. But it's corner infield day here on the podcast, and that's an interesting spot for this Nationals team. This team's got to feel good about the hot corner after what Anthony Rendon did last year, but questions remain at first base. So let's start there with Ryan Zimmerman. Ryan Zimmerman's still just 32 years old, which kind of blows my mind a little bit, Jamal, because the way it's gone the last few years, it seems like he's an aging ball player, but that's not the case. He's, of course, had the injury issues, the plantar fasciitis last year. They kind of eased him in, and he just had a terrible season at the plate. So from a health standpoint, it seems like he's in a better spot this year heading into 2017. Is that true?
Yeah, that's definitely true. Coming up in 2015, he missed a lot of time with the plantar fasciitis. And that was kind of the reason that they decided to ease him in here. Not exactly sure how that was going to react, how much it would hamper him, how much it would limit him. And really in spring training, I don't think he played a game in spring training until about mid-March. And Zim has kind of admitted just the way his swing and his footwork and everything kind of sets up. It does take him a while to kind of get his rhythm and get everything put together. And I kind of wonder that since he did kind of get a late start, intentionally late start on spring and in the workouts and such, was that just the fact that he was still trying to find his rhythm for so much of the season and then had a couple other injuries kind of set him back as well, other things that kind of never let him really get into a groove. So right now he's healthy. We saw him at Mass Winterfest in D.C. last month, and he said he already started working out. He had already started kind of getting ready for the season to come. So, he looks like he's ahead of schedule from where he was last year. Interesting to see whether or not they still try to limit him somewhat, or whether they'll say, okay, we're going to go full go, because he did play more games last year than he had been kind of the last couple of years, but just kind of was not effective and productive, I should say, when he was out there. So this position is probably, I wrote about it this week, it's probably one of the most perplexing positions for the Nationals, because they know who's going to start. They know Zim is going to be the starter. But you kind of have no idea what exactly you're going to get from him. But they've also kind of committed to him as being their starting first baseman and going forward with him. So it's kind of a make or break year for him and his future with the Nets.
Yeah, and traditionally, obviously, first base is a position where you expect to get some offensive pop out of. So you hope he can deliver that again. And like we said, he's just 32 years old. So you would hope, if healthy, he can figure it out. Go ahead.
That's the thing. He's not old necessarily. Yeah. Like you said, he's been around forever. He made his debut at age 20. So that's why it kind of feels, and obviously the injuries to last year have also been, last couple of years has been a thing. But, it's a guy, like you said, still 32, but he's coming off three seasons where he's been injured, or not very effective, and his numbers are kind of, rip heels are all going the wrong way. 3 years, you can kind of still make, I don't say excuses, but you can kind of say, okay, well, this thing went wrong or this thing happened or whatever. But if he goes to a fourth consecutive year where he just is not very good or not very productive, that's kind of when you have to figure out something here and either try to part ways or try to make an improvement somewhere, an upgrade somewhere.
How about defensively? Because obviously he's a guy who was a third baseman for much of his career. He's moved over to first base. How far has he come as a defensive first baseman?
This is an odd one here. The metrics hate him. The metrics do not rate him well. He's only played first base really the last two seasons. Watching him every day, and of course, the old eye test is what it is, but watching him and just some of the things he can, people throwing him, some of the things that he does make at first base, he seems about average, seems to be fine, doesn't kind of make anything egregious or anything really spectacular. So, he's an interesting first baseman in that he's not probably a plus defender. At best, he's probably an average defender. And it's first base, so you can kind of get away with that if you have the offense or the power and stuff to make up for it. But, probably at best an average defensive first baseman, and on some days a little worse than that.
When you look across the diamond to third base, Anthony Rendon, obviously a huge bounce back season in 2016, although he got off to a slow start as well. I remember early in the season we talked about it a little bit on this podcast with Bill Latson about the fact that there was starting to be questions of when or if he would ever kind of come around and get back to the guy that he was back in 2014. But he did that, and he finished really strong and overall had a really solid season. The power numbers were there, the RBIs were there, and the average wasn't what I think it can be, but it was good enough at 270, the OBP 348. This is the Anthony Rendon the Nationals thought they were going to have year after year after year, and now it looks like he will be again.
Yeah, similar. I mean, going into last year and into that first half, this is also a huge question mark because Rendon obviously had the big breakout in 2014, and then in 2015 he was hurt, but then also really not very good when he was playing. And he really, after like you said, that start, it was pretty abysmal. And you kind of wondered exactly what kind of player he was going to be. I questioned, especially the power numbers. I never thought we're going to get 20 home runs years ago. And of course, he gets 20 again this year. It really kind of silenced all those doubts and has shown that he's going to be a piece for them in the middle of this order. Really, besides maybe Trey Turner and Daniel Murphy, he was their hottest hitter in the second half. So really, just like you said, it's kind of get very comforting for them that they know this is a guy they have locked in. He's only in his second year of arbitration was this year. So they've got him locked up for the next couple of years. He's a guy who's plays really great defense over there at third base and is going to be a kind of valuable bat in the middle of that lineup. So a huge year for Rendon. He's won the comeback player of the year and really, like you said, established himself as a premier third base. So third base is a loaded position around majors in general, but he's definitely one of the premier third basemen in the National League.
Yeah, and you mentioned him defensively, and one of the reasons Zimmerman moved over to first, Rendon, the far superior defender at third base. How do the advanced metrics view him as a third baseman? Because he certainly passes the eye test. I mean, he's a guy that you see make the spectacular play and the steady play. Do the numbers like him, too?
They do. They do like him a lot, and I mean, it's the kind of thing that he was at, living 2 years ago, too. He was moved to second base, kind of just when they had acquired Yunel Escobar, and Escobar felt a lot more comfortable at third base, wasn't really to move from third base. So, we kind of forced Rendon to move, which, really kind of hurt them in 2015 because Rendon is such a superior defender. The metrics like him a lot. You can obviously just watch him and see. He's a guy who was a Gold Glove finalist this year and probably could win a couple of Gold Gloves, I should say. But just third base is so, so stacked. You look at a guy like Arenado, who could win the Gold Glove every single year, especially in the National League. Chris Bryant, he's going to have a case for that if he he moves around positions a lot, but he's a great-looking third baseman. And Rendon's a guy who at some point could probably sneak in there and get one, or get a Gold Glove or something, but he's a really good defender. Last year, the strength of that left side of the infield with him and Espinoza really kind of, the Nats really benefited from just some of the balls that they really got to and ate up over on that over that left side there. But he's even more important right now defensively because of the way that the Nats have had to kind of move things around. Obviously, Espinoza being gone and some of the other defensive questions they're going to have, Rendon's going to be one of the guys who is a sure thing. That's a plus defender and a good defender. So he's very valuable in that respect. And especially, would you see him, if he doesn't get off to the slow start that he did in the first half of last year, get put together a complete season and a season to mirror to kind of what he was doing in the second half and what he did a couple of years ago. It's an exciting time for them to think about what exactly they have with Rendon, who also is still very young and still could be getting better.
All right. How about bench pieces for the corners? Yeah. Wilmer Difoe is there on the roster. Clint Robinson. Are both those guys safe to make this team, or is there going to be a little competition as far as backup infield work in spring training?
Yeah, Clint Robinson, I think, is an almost sure thing. He really did not have a great season last year either, but he's a guy who can cheat still under contract, has some power. They like him a lot as far as what he did a couple of years ago especially. So I would think that barring something unforeseen, he's kind of a backup. They're going to be the backup first baseman. And Wilmer Difoe will probably play more middle infield, I should say. But they had him working out at third base a lot last year, too, to kind of increase his versatility a little bit. I would expect during spring training you'll see him get some reps over there, too. They don't really have a natural backup third baseman at the moment. Steven Drew, who's a free agent now, was kind of filling that role last year. They probably love to have Steven Drew back. He's kind of looking out for a starting role to see if he can land somewhere at second base or shortstop potentially. He's still out there in the market, and if his market still kind of stalls for the next couple of weeks, you might see him be able to the Nats be able to snag him back on some kind of contract to come back and join their bench. But, yeah, right now, you know, unless they bring some other people in, which I think they're going to try to bring some competition in, definitely, you know, whether it be some veterans or some young players. Emmanuel Burris is one of them who's going to compete for some middle infield spots and potentially the third base spot as well. You know, right now you think that, that Defoe is the favorite to you know, be a backup, the backup infielder, backup utility guy, but I wouldn't necessarily call him a lock at this moment just yet.
All right, great stuff as always. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. That's it for your corner infield. Next week we tackle up the middle in the infield. Thanks for joining us on this podcast. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Mets reporter Anthony DiComo as we continue to make our way around the Mets roster as we get ready for the 2017 season and spring training down in Port St. Lucie, which is, I think, technically less than a month away now as far as pitchers and catchers reporting. Today on the podcast, we cover the corner infield, which is a spot which most teams depend upon for strength. The Mets would like that to be the case. But, Anthony, there's certainly a lot of question marks around third base and first base for this team in 2017. The good thing is, at least at third base, it seems like there's a backup plan. But let's start there at the hot corner. If all goes well, David Wright will be healthy. And while he's not going to play 150 games, certainly for this team, he'll be in there well over 100 games, have a nice season, and all will be happy in Flushing. What are the chances that actually happens?
Well, it seems like we've had the same conversation regarding David Wright pretty much every year for the last 4 or 5 years, and that is, you know, maybe not the most likeliest thing in the world that he'll be healthy, but the Mets are hoping that he will be. And every year that goes by, it becomes a little less likely, a little less hard to see that happening. You know, it's been a few years now since David Wright has had a full healthy season. He's coming off that neck surgery that robbed him of most of last season, and you know, you can focus on the neck and on that aspect of his health, but another thing that people don't really talk about that did was it kind of took him away from all the intensive rehab and physical therapy and everything he was doing to keep his back in shape. He still has spinal stenosis. He will have spinal stenosis for the rest of his life. And only just now is he really getting back into baseball activities here in January. And really, is he able to start to get back into those physical therapy exercises and whatnot that allow him to get on the field. You know, we talked about in 2015 how David Wright was needing to show up at the ballpark at crazy hours in the afternoon, 6-7 hours before game time, just to make it onto the field. And that's the type of thing that's not going to go away. And I'm not trying to paint a grim picture here, but it's just reality for David Wright at age 34. It certainly does not mean he cannot be a productive player for the Mets, and the Mets are holding out hope that he can be. This is a guy who is still the heart and soul of the franchise. He's obviously the captain. And the past couple of years, particularly down the stretch in 2015, when he was healthy, when he was able to get on the field, he was reasonably productive, at least on the offensive side. Certainly there are some questions about him defensively. Can he still hack it at third base, particularly with his throwing? Is he going to be strong enough to make those throws consistently across the diamond? But the Mets are hopeful for all of this, and they know that if there's one player around baseball who's going to put in the work, if there's one player around baseball who is capable of overcoming all of these things that we're talking about, all of these doomsday-type chats that we have about David Wright, it is David Wright. He's the guy who will put in that work, who will do everything within his power, that he possibly can to get on the field and to stay on the field. And what does that ultimately look like? Nobody knows. David Wright doesn't know. Terry Collins doesn't know. Certainly you or I do not know. But the Mets are hopeful, yeah, that he can play. Maybe it's 3 out of every 4 games. Maybe it's 4 out of every 5. Maybe it's 2 out of every 5. But whatever it can be, will be a nice thing for the Mets because he is their leader. He is their captain. David Wright is the guy that still, while he might not be the most important player from an X's and O's standpoint at this point in his career, he is the heart and soul of this team, and the Mets sorely need him.
And when Wright's not out there at third base, more than likely Jose Reyes is the guy that steps in, whether that's when Wright gets days off or in a more permanent role if Wright gets hurt for a long period of time. At least that's a nice backup plan to have.
Yeah, and last year, you know, the Mets went into spring training with Wilmer Flores as that guy, and he was supposed to be the super sub who was going to play all 4 infield positions, which he did. but he didn't do it necessarily particularly well for much of the summer. He had some injuries himself. Wilmer Flores did. He didn't really distinguish himself defensively on the left side of the infield, and he certainly didn't distinguish himself offensively against right-handed pitchers. He kind of developed into a platoon player, really good against lefties, but not that productive against righties. I think the Mets have a lot more confidence going into 2017 with Jose Reyes as that backup plan. He's going to play at third base. He's going to play at shortstop. He might even play a little second. He might even play a little outfield, but third base is where the Mets really need Jose Reyes the most, because even if David Wright is healthy, you're going to see Jose Reyes starting at third base once or twice per week. You know, David Wright will need that rest, first of all. And second of all, the Mets really like Jose Reyes as their everyday or close to everyday leadoff hitter, so they're going to find ways to get him in the lineup. He's the one regular on this team that still has some speed. Now, he's not the burner he was back in 2007, 2008, but he's still pretty quick there on the base paths. He can still steal a base every now and then, and he's still a very good hitter, I think underrated throughout his career for just his hitting skill. Obviously won a batting title back in 2012, I believe it was. So the Mets are excited about what Jose Reyes can bring. This was part of the deal when they signed him last summer, was that they negotiated having him under team control for 2017, and it's really important given the state of David Wright, because maybe Jose Reyes starts 40 games at third base this year. Maybe he starts 140 games at third base this year. I don't think either possibility would be super surprising. And the Mets, just given what David Wright has gone through, given the uncertainty regarding his health, they really need Jose Reyes to step up and be a factor at third base, regardless of what happens with anyone else.
All right, you move across the diamond, and Lucas Duda is obviously a guy who's capable of hitting 30 home runs in a season, capable of being a guy you can depend on in the middle of that lineup. That wasn't the case a year ago because of injuries. And once he went down, really it was guy after guy the Mets tried to plug the hole with, and nothing really worked out. So Duda seems like, while Wright's important, there's a backup plan. It seems like there's still really no backup plan for Lucas Duda at first base. He needs to play well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not that same type of safety net. You've got Wilmer Flores back there, and he will start at first base, certainly against left-handed pitchers. But, you know, if Lucas Duda gets hurt again and you're forced to plug Wilmer Flores in there every day at first base against right-handed pitchers, this offense might be in a little bit of trouble. But they're, again, confident as they are with all players that Lucas Duda will be healthy. And look, I'm a Lucas Duda apologist. I have been for a long time. He's not the most popular player with fans, but I do think he deserves a little more credit for what he's done, certainly in 2014 and 2015, before the injury last year. He was a really rock-solid player over there at first base. He was a good defender, and he had 30 homer power. He had, I believe, 58 home runs between those two seasons. And, you know, while that's not like the mashers out there, that's not like the Paul Goldschmidts of the world, the Freddie Freemans, maybe the best offensive players at that position, is an average to above average production level at first base. And really, he was not the Mets' problem. Lucas Duda was a good player. And if he can just get back to that level, he doesn't need to be the guy, the engine that carries this offense. That's what Yoenis Cespedes is here for. The Mets are looking to their outfielders for a lot of production. Certainly they're looking to their middle infielders, and Asdrubal Cabrera and Neil Walker, for a lot of power production. So they just need Lucas Duda to be a steady left-handed power contributor at first base. And the most important thing Lucas Duda can do is get out there 140-plus times. The Mets are pretty confident that his back woes are behind him, and he'll be able to do that. But like you said, there's not a lot of safety net back there. So he's a very important player, I think underrated important player for a Mets team that really got very, very little production out of first base last year. James Loney did a nice job at times, but he also had long stretches of the summer where he just was not productive at all in replacing Lucas Duda. Well, now Duda's back, and he kind of needs to get back to those levels of production that he showed in 2014. In 2015, and he's still a relatively young player, early 30s. There's no reason why he can't do it.
How about the defense from Duda? Because obviously the play in the World Series stands out in fans' minds as kind of his maybe a disastrous example of defense. But overall, how is Duda around the bag when you get to see him on a day-to-day basis? I know he's not great as far as the metrics go.
Yeah, you know, I think he's actually a little underrated. I think he's an average, maybe slightly below average defensive first baseman, but he showed flashes where he can move pretty well, and he can even at times has put together some stretches, full seasons, I would say, where he's been above average. So I think, you know, it's one of those situations where I always talk about Carlos Beltran, right? One of the greatest, if not the greatest, free agent signings the Mets have ever had, but disliked by and large. And a big part of that is because of one play in his career, and that was the called strike three against Adam Wainwright in the 2006 NLCS. Does that really change the fact that he helped bring the Mets there, that he was this super productive player for 7 years? No, it shouldn't. And nor do I think one play in Lucas Duda's career should change what Mets fans think about him. It wasn't a great play, but certainly Lucas Duda feels that he should have made that play, but it shouldn't overshadow what he's accomplished with the Mets. And he has accomplished quite a bit. Again, those 30 homer seasons, he certainly has never been bad defensively over there at first base. You know, I think Lucas Duda deserves a little bit more credit than maybe a lot of fans are willing to give him. And that is defensively as well as offensively.
Well, that's your New York Mets corner infield position. It's a spot that could be a strong point for this team. Who knows? Or there could be a lot of question marks throughout the 2017 season. Only time will tell. That'll do it for this edition of MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DeComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. We'll cover the middle infield. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Marlins reporter, Joe Fusaro. And Joe, a little breaking news here on the podcast as we record this on Thursday afternoon. The Marlins have gone out and acquired another starting pitcher to add to the mix, Dan Straley from the Cincinnati Reds. They give up some prospects going back the other way, but Straley's a guy who seemed to really figure things out in 2016. The Marlins get 4 years of control for a guy who won 14 games on a bad baseball team with the Reds in 2016. Where do you think Straley fits into this Marlins rotation?
Tim, that's a great question because, you know, right now they got six guys for five spots. And so, you know, Straley comes at a high cost. They parted with Luis Castillo and Austin Bryce, two of their more promising pitching prospects, and then outfielder Isaiah White, the number 16th rated Marlins prospect. So, you know, they gave up a lot, and like you noted, they have 4 years of control, and he's coming off a very good year when you look at it, as noted, on a team that wasn't so good. And pitching, I know he gave up, 31 homers and, you know, playing in Great American Ballpark, Marlins Park, a lot more hitter-friendly than that. So I envision him being in the back of the rotation. The question is, who, if he is for sure in, who is not? Because obviously earlier in the offseason they got Edison Volquez, who clearly is, and will pitch at, you know, somewhere in the first two or three spots. And also Jeff Locke, the left-hander from the Pirates. So it will be very interesting to see, you know, how it plays out in spring training. Those things kind of sometimes take care of themselves because someone you're not expecting to may go down with an injury. But in the meantime, they added a guy who threw 191 and change innings last year. They're looking for durability in their rotation, and they got a guy who they're hoping will continue more of the same after having an up and down career.
Yeah, certainly no team gets through the season with five starters, so it's always good to have that sixth guy at some point. You mentioned the up and down career, and Straley was a prospect in the A's organization, I remember, years ago, and then he came up at a young age and had some early success and then just kind of seemed to lose it, and to the point where I think a lot of baseball had kind of given up on this guy, but the Reds took a chance on him, and they were able to flip him now to the Marlins, and he really seemed to figure things out. So it'll be intriguing to see how he pitches, and you made a good point about moving to Marlins Park and how that could actually help him out even more, and plus being on a better baseball team overall than he was with the Reds. So one of those guys you mentioned isn't going to be in the rotation, which leads us to our main topic for the day on the podcast, which is breaking down this Marlins bullpen, because whoever isn't in the rotation, you would think will probably find a spot in that bullpen. So who would you think, if you had to handicap it now, of those six guys, who makes the most sense to pitch out of the bullpen, or would that guy end up down in AAA?
Well, it's a couple of interesting things. There really isn't room to go down to AAA, because you can have Tom Kohler, who just, you know, settled in arbitration for over $4 million. I believe it was $4 million. I think it's 5.7, excuse me. So, obviously, he's got his spot, either, you know, in the rotation. You know, you got Adam Connolly, who is going into a second full season. he's got real high-end stuff. He might be the best pitcher they have, so he's not going down. And, you know, Wei-Yin Chen had a lot of injury issues last year. I think they're probably going to be a little concerned about him and his health. So I kind of almost wonder if Straley was brought in as kind of a safety net if Chen isn't doing well. But, you know, it is interesting. Does Jeff Locke, who comes at $3 million and has pitched in the pen, kind of go into that long relief role and gives them a left-hander in the bullpen? Not that I think that's been a priority, because they kind of been looking for, you know, quality the best they can. But this trade on the flip side, Tim, kind of hurts, you know, kind of the big picture, which was to build this super bullpen. And a lot of people, you know, probably aren't going to think that Austin Bryce was going to be a huge factor. But this kid threw close to 100 miles an hour, multi-inning capability, and offered really, you know, a good option down at AAA had he stayed in the organization. So you're losing a bit of that super bullpen depth in losing Bryce. And I just wonder, you know, I guess if I had to say, assuming Straley's in a rotation, Locke would probably be the guy that seemed to be the guy to make the most sense to go into the bullpen. But, you know, I've covered this sport and this team too long to know that as you draw it up on in late January, isn't exactly how it pans out by the time opening day comes around.
Yeah, that is for sure. More in the bullpen. This is a team that really wanted to bolster that bullpen this offseason, went after some of the biggest names on the free agent market, didn't come out of it with any of them, but then ended up still adding some great depth. Guys like Brad Ziegler, Junichi Tozawa, and then they have some arms in there as well. But when you talk about a bullpen, you got to start with the closer. And A.J. Ramos was really good in 2016. How confident are the Marlins that he'll be just as good this season?
Well, the one thing that I think Marlin fans have seen out of A.J. Ramos is consistency. You know, he's not going to be the guy who's going to go first on a fantasy teams as the top closer. You know, he's a guy that got into the All-Star game last year, basically earned it. You know, he pitched at a really, really high level in the first half, had 40 saves on the season, only blew three opportunities, and pitched, you know, with a jammed, little fracture in his finger in August, and that kind of marred him in the second half. But, you know, you're going to get real consistency. You're going to get a guy who's not intimidated by the moment, a guy with four pitches, a guy who could kind of ramp it up a little bit more. He pitches kind of 92, 93, but can ramp it up to 96, 97 if he wanted to. But, you know, here's a guy that needs four pitches to get guys out. And when his fastball slider, he throws the change. And, you know, in the curve, he's really, really effective. But, you know, he's the type of guy also, what do they call it, the top stepper, you know, for the manager. And the fans don't always kind of like what, if he's pitching around guys or, you know, not being afraid to walk to get out of a jam, he kind of lives on the edge, and that makes people nervous, as obviously. So, you know, in Ramos, you know what you're getting, and you're just going to get kind of a consistent bulldog performer and who's been very durable. So I think you're going to get more of the same.
When you talk about those two new guys that I mentioned in Ziegler and Tozawa, both of them has experience as setup men. Ziegler's obviously been a closer as well in his career. Tozawa had some failed attempts at being a closer in Boston a little bit, but are those two battling for the eighth inning job, or are they going to kind of mix and match throughout the season?
I think that's where we're going. I mean, if this rotation is kind of a four, five, six inning rotation, then, you know, all these guys, all conventional roles are going to kind of go out the window. But you also have Barraclough, who's really nasty, and obviously he walks guys, but his strikeout rate was tops among all National League relievers last year. He averaged, 14 Ks per nine. So, you know, I'm not ruling him out. But Ziegler, obviously, I think is going to be in the seventh or eighth. David Phelps, I also think, is going to be in that mix with Barraclough. And Tozawa, I think, is going to be more in that sixth inning, seventh inning matchup type of situation. So, you know, they got six guys who they're very, very confident and comfortable with. You know, we're leaving Dustin McGowan, who had a really good bounce back year last year in a relief role with the Marlins, over 50 innings pitched. They signed him. He hit the free agent market. They brought him back. So I kind of see him as that bridge middle inning guy. And in the five that, you know, the four that we've just mentioned, I think I've noted before, I wouldn't be shocked if they get on a, you know, on a winning streak and are using these guys, that one day you could see Phelps, Barraclough, AJ, and then the next day Tozawa, Ziegler, AJ. I think that they could get kind of in a pattern as something like that as well.
The one thing that you don't really see here when looking at this bullpen is a really go-to lefty. Is that something that's still available that they're still searching for, or what's the situation with the left-handed side of the bullpen?
That would surprise me. I know what the Jerry Blevins types are out there, but I don't know what the dollars are. It would only be if that player came at you know, made so much sense at a really reasonable contract. But, you know, when you saw the Cecil deal with St. Louis and what, you know, some of these, you know, Mike Dunn, who left here to go to Colorado, getting $19 million for 3 or 4 years, whatever it was. You know, when those lefty guys are getting $6, $7 million a year, you know, I don't see the Marlins saying, oh, we need to have that. You know, I think also when you look at the good KC bullpens, you know, they're going righty, 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 you know, at the end, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th, and sometimes the 6th as well. That, you know, it's not like, oh, you need a lefty to go get Bryce Harper now. I think they're going to take their chances with Barraclough and Phelps rather than, you know, they have Hunter Cervenka. He's on the 40-man. He's pitching to big leagues. They got him in a trade with Atlanta. But, you know, he also had his struggles. If he figures it out at some point in the year, I think he will have a role. But, you know, he seems a long shot to make it the opening day roster. He'd probably go down to Triple-A. And then I think they play it by year, you know, whether Justin Nicolino, if he's in the big leagues, either in a rotation or if they have to go in the bullpen. But Justin isn't an overpowering guy either, but he's a guy. And then we know that Jeff Locke conceivably can pitch out of the bullpen as well. He's done that in Pittsburgh. So you're not going to have that true situational lefty guy, and it doesn't look like this year. But I think that there's a really good variety of sinker ball pitchers, the split out of Tozawa, and then you got the fastball slider out of Barraclough Phelps, who was running it up at 96, 97 last year, you know, throwing, you know, really, really nasty stuff, good, really good breaking ball as well. And then you got some power arms that may open up in the minors as well, and Brian Ellington, who could bring it 100. And Nick Wittgren is a guy I really, really like a lot. He's a right-hander. He should be on this team, but, you know, he also has options. He may find himself in that in AAA only because type of mode. So, you know, I think they're going to have a lot of different looks for hitters and variety without necessarily having a left-hander.
Something to be said for having a real good right-hander to get lefties out as opposed to a mediocre lefty to get lefties out. So
yeah,
certainly teams have had success without having that go-to lefty, and the Marlins will hope for that. All right, well, that's a wrap of your 2017 Marlins bullpen as it stands right now, and obviously it's very early and bullpens tend to change quite a bit from the beginning of spring training through the end of the season. So certainly something to watch, but there's some talented arms there for the Marlins. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Frisaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Braves reporter, Mark Bowman. And, Mark, we continue to dig into the roster of the Braves. Spring training coming up fast. So we're going to talk about the bullpen, which is maybe the least secured and clearly laid out position as far as this Braves roster goes. A lot of familiar names from a year ago. The question mark is, I guess, where they all fit into things. And when you talk about a bullpen, I guess you start with the closer, and Jim Johnson seems like he's that guy. Pitched 65 games a year ago, the ERA a little over 3. He's a guy who's closed a lot in his career. He's had up and down stints in his career as far as effectiveness, but where does he fit in as far as the Braves? How confident are they in him in a ninth inning?
You know, I think that last year was a fitting example. You just didn't know what to expect from Jim Johnson. Or let's even go back 2 years ago. Let's go back 2 years ago when he's coming off the season where he spent with the A's and the Tigers, and the Braves getting, you know, for a bargain price. They lure him to Atlanta with the opportunity to work with a former sinker baller, Roger McDowell, and he and Roger had a great relationship. And I think that you saw Jim Johnson pitch effectively when he was in Atlanta. He went to L.A. Midway through that 2016 season with a trade and struggled. Is that just fact that he was away from Roger? Not necessarily. You know, I'm not going to say that. There was an injury there, but at the same time, he just wasn't the same. Johnson has proven to be a guy who
he finds some comfort spots, it appears. You know, he obviously was comfortable pitching in Baltimore and Atlanta, and I think that's why he signed the two-year deal there on the last day of the regular season. At the time, the Braves said he'd be their closer. The interesting thing, obviously, was a few days later, they got rid of Roger McDowell. So, look, Jim Johnson's been around the block long enough. He knows how to fix himself. But at the same time, just a year ago, he starts off the season so poorly that they send him to the they put him on the disabled list with what was essentially a phantom injury just to get him down to Orlando to work on things for about a month. And when he did come back up in June, he did pitch effectively through the rest of the season and handled that closer's role, especially after Aroldis Vizcaíno got hurt. And, you know, if Johnson struggles, Vizcaíno, if he's healthy, what we saw of him at the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, you know, he was a guy who can handle that closer's role. So there's a lot of depth in this bullpen, but at the same time, you can't just roll the dice and say they're going to pitch as effectively as they did during the final 2 months of last season. So there has to be some depth, and the Braves have tried to create some depth with some non-roster invitees.
You mentioned Vizcaíno, and is he he's the setup guy, I guess, as long as Johnson is effective in the closing role.
Yes, yeah, he would be there. You know, you've got him right there, and you've got Mauricio Cabrera and Jose Ramirez are very interesting in the fact that, you know, he entered last year saying, here's two guys that can, you know, basically light up any radar gun, Cabrera especially. He's the one guy who challenged Chapman for top radar readings on a daily basis. But, you know, at the same time, they haven't been around the block long enough for us to say, okay, they're going to continue this throw strikes. Now, yes, they made the proper adjustments last year. You hope they come back and are that guy. But at this stage of their career, you have to remember they're not too far removed from being a couple guys who you said, can they ever get out of the minors and throw enough strikes to stay at the big league level? Ramirez was DFA'd at the beginning of last year. He was put on the roster because he was out of options. He passes through waivers. And he made the right adjustments at AAA. Cabrera made a successful jump from AA. Those two guys are there, but that's why, you know, you'd like to think that they're going to pitch as effectively as they did. You'd like to think that Rivero, the Rule 5 pick from the Cubs, is going to step in and be what you hope he'd be. But at the same time, you know, the Cubs didn't protect him for a reason. You know, obviously they do have a deep system, and, you know, you want to go pick from the best if you can in a Rule 5. But at the same time, you know, he's far from a long shot. So I think that's why you've seen the Braves go out and get a guy like Blaine Boyer last week, bring in a guy who has pitched effectively. He hasn't missed a lot of bats over the last few years, but his ERA speaks for itself. And, you know, he's coming off two consecutive seasons with 60-plus appearances. He's really excited to come home and pitch in Atlanta. So I got a feeling that he's going to fit in that bullpen mix some way, somehow. Even if you throw in that Josh Coleman is probably going to be the long guy there. Ian Kroll is going to be the lefty. Ian didn't get a lot of lefties out last year. Let's put it this way. He wasn't as effective against lefties as you'd like maybe your top lefty guy to be. But at the same time, he was overall pretty effective once he came back up from the minor league level. He started the year with AAA. So you're looking, you know, the more I talk and explain where these guys were at some point last year, you see why, yes, there's depth. Yes, they do have a lot of options. But at the same time, you know, exactly how effective these options remains to be seen how similar they pitched to the way they did at the end of last year when this bullpen was pretty good.
You mentioned Kroll, and he threw 63 games last year for this team. There's a guys that got a lot of experience last year, as you mentioned, as well. And I think you pretty much rattled off all the names that are going to be involved there. But when you look at the rotation of this team and the amount of different arms there are there in the rotation with the additions of R.A. Dickey and Bartolo Colon and what that has meant to kind of push everybody down a little bit, some of these young arms that are starters as far as how they've come up through the minor leagues, if they're not going to make this rotation, are they destined to just remain starters in the minors for now to keep those innings going? Or could some of those guys challenge to have a roster spot but in the bullpen?
No, I do think that they will end up, you know, continuing to start. We're looking, you know, primarily at Aaron Blair and Matt Whistler when we say this from an immediate standpoint. I think you've got to continue to have these guys start. You do have enough other options to fill your bullpen. And you know, I think along with wanting to find guys that they eat innings, maybe be a little bit more consistent than Whistler and Blair were, certainly, but last year, you could go out and get these veterans. But at the same time, I don't think, you know, it works for 2017. You just have to hope that what you're doing for immediate results, you know, along with motivating Whistler and Blair, maybe giving them a little kick in the rear, just saying, hey, look, nothing is given in this game. You have to work and earn yourself, earn a spot back here. You're also, you know, maybe you're winning more games this year with these guys than maybe you would have with Whistler and Blair, but you have to remain cognizant of the big picture, and you have to hope that what benefits 2017 doesn't hinder 2018 when, if you need some of these guys, you know, Whistler and Blair, that when they come up, they start going through some of the growing pains that maybe they could have gone, you know, continued that process this year. And, you know, the reason it would be more detrimental is, you know, obviously this is a team that's trying to get better every year. 2017, they have some optimism for 2018. They definitely want to be in the playoff picture. So you hope that what you do to benefit 2017 with those starters doesn't hinder or prove to be a detriment for 2018.
Yeah, and I mean, they've certainly shown that there is still work to be done as far as the minor league level, I think, with these guys. And you thought Whistler was maybe going to be a guy that was solidly in the rotation. That hasn't quite developed. Maybe he will be, but Blair certainly some work to do as well. And all those other young arms, you feel like if all those young arms are together in the minor league level too, that maybe isn't a bad thing for these guys to go through stuff together and be able to share experiences.
Yeah. I mean, I think it helps to be able to lean on a guy. And those two guys are pretty close. They're good friends and they can push each other. But at the same time, you have to wonder if, I've heard it time and time again from the guys that have gone through the process. You develop at the minor league level, you truly learn at the big league level. Yes, you learn what you have to do to get to the big league level at the minors, but sometimes I think it's more of a live and learn process. You've got to be there and do it there at the big league level to truly, you know, whether you truly are ready to stay there. It's not easy to get there, and it's even harder to stay there. So, not only do you have Blair and Whistler fighting for, you know, maybe some time this year, but by this time next year, you and I are going to be talking about how they're fighting to stave off Newcomb or Freed, Patrick Weigel, you know, because this next wave is coming, and all three of those guys will probably be at least deemed big league ready by this time next year.
Yeah, a lot of arms on the way. Our talk of the bullpen skewed a little ways into the rotation again, but that's what happens when you have all these young arms, I think, Mark. But great stuff, and spring training will certainly be interesting to see all these arms and how they are this year after what you said, a lot of them coming so far in 2016, the Ramirez's and the Cabrera's, to see if they can jump off from where they left off in 2016. That'll do it for this edition of MLB.com Extras. It was our Braves edition with Mark Bowman. I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Phillies reporter, Todd Zalecki. Todd, throughout this offseason, we've kind of talked about the fact that the Phillies wanted to add another veteran bat, a corner outfielder if possible, and they've done that here with Michael Saunders. And so that's a perfect time for us to continue our kind of around the roster talk with the outfield here this week on the podcast. And we'll start with Michael Saunders. It's a 1-year deal. There's a club option for 2018 as well. And that might be intriguing depending upon what happens with Saunders as far as his season goes, because 2016 was really interesting for Michael Saunders. He had a tremendous first half, all-star caliber player for the Blue Jays through the first half of the season. And then he really fell off the cliff. I mean, the average dipped under 200 for the second half of the season. So when the Phillies looked at him, what was the most intriguing part of Michael Saunders when they went to sign him?
Well, I think a few things. He's a left-handed bat that can hit for power. He can play left field, right field. He's going to play right field for the Phillies. He's also played some center field. And what he also mentioned, 1 year, $9 million contract with a club option. The whole offseason, as we've talked before, has been geared about, you know, acquiring players in the final year of their deal, like Howie Kendrick, Pat Neshek, or guys on one-year contracts like Saunders, like Clay Buchholz, you know, Jeremy Hellickson's on a one-year deal, you know, Joaquin Benoit's on a one-year deal to maintain that, you know, roster financial flexibility. But certainly, you know, Phillies manager Pete McCannon has been asking, I think probably since late July, early August, he's been asking for a kind of a middle-of-the-lineup type of hitter, and they got one in Saunders, at least for the short term.
Yeah, that's McCannon. I remember us talking about it mid-season maybe last year. He was already saying about, hey, next year we need to bring another bat in, and he's certainly right. The guy. Now, what made them go the route of Saunders as opposed to, we had talked about a guy like Brandon Moss? Is Moss really stuck on trying to get 2 years? Is that what this came down to, is maybe contract length?
Certainly, that could be one reason. Maybe Brandon just doesn't look at the Phillies as an opportunity for the postseason, which certainly is understandable. The Phillies are rebuilding. So I think maybe a combination of those things. He might want to play for a winner and maybe the contract length. So I think from the Phillies' point of view, they were happy to get one of those two guys. They also had been kind of keeping their eye on Jay Bruce. If the Mets decided at some point to unload him, kind of like the Red Sox did with Clay Buchholz, you know, take a top 30-ish prospect for Clay Buchholz. Oh, Phillies are like, oh, we can't turn that deal down. That would have been kind of what would have maybe had the Phillies jump in the market on Bruce. So Philly, basically, hey, Saunders, if you get Saunders, they weren't, you know, so much in love with Brandon Moss over Michael Saunders. I think they kind of looked at all those guys as similar players. Corner outfielders that can hit for power, that are basically going to be on one-year contracts.
Yeah, and Saunders probably a little bit better as far as the outfield goes than Moss. And Saunders not on AstroTurf may be a nice bonus, too. He's been playing in Toronto. The grass in Philadelphia may be a good thing for him as well. Is he flippable with that club option if he has a great season for a team that needs a bat at July, to know that they could also keep him for an extra year if they wanted to?
Yeah, I think so. Pretty much every move that they have made has been with that in kind of the back of the Phillies' mind. Can we flip this guy come July 31st if we need to? Now, you know, Matt Klentak, the Phillies GM, has said, hey, listen, I would prefer not to trade any of these guys and have us kind of play over our heads a little bit and be, you know, on the kind of the outskirts of the wild card race, or maybe be, you know, kind of one of the surprise teams in the National League come the end of July. But if not, if that does not happen, they want to have as many options as possible to flip these players for a prospect or two that can maybe help them 2 or 3 years down the road, or maybe even next season. And Saunders, you know, obviously fits into that category. And boy, if he ends up having the first half that he had last year for Toronto, and the Phillies are out of it and looking to make a trade, they could actually end up doing pretty well with this signing.
Yeah, I would think so as well. So he'll slot in right field. There's also a new left fielder in 2017 for the Phillies, and that is Howie Kendrick. You mentioned him in the one-year situation for him in Philadelphia as well. He's kind of new to the outfield. How does he stack up as far as playing in the outfield? Because it's a limited sample size still, obviously. He was an infielder for the majority of his career. But the Phillies have enough confidence that he can get things done out in left field?
Yeah, they do. I think, you know, they're not going into it thinking that he's going to be a gold glover out there. But I think they believe that he's somebody that can at least play competently, go out and catch a ball, catch what's hit to him, you know, maybe cut off a few balls here and there. But yes, you know, they don't think he's Roman Quinn or Aaron Altair or Odubel Herrera. But, you know, and they didn't get him for that. They got him because they think he's been the analytics show that the Phillies believe that he can have a bounce. He's in store for a bounce back year offensively. And they looked at him as an upgrade over what they had last year in left field. So they're going to get what they get from him defensively, but they really did get him for the offense and a little bit of the veteran presence that they're kind of lacking right now. Although Michael Saunders, adding him adds a little bit of help too.
And then in center field, it's the one spot in this outfield where you have the young guy who could be a contributor to this Phillies team for years. Obviously, Odubo Herrera, an all-star type player in 2016. Is he secure as far as this team thinking of him as the center fielder of the future at this point? Or are there still question marks around Odubo Herrera?
I think based off of what I've heard, I think they're pretty sold on him as a center fielder. Now, that can change, but you know, mid-season last year, Pete McCannon got pretty frustrated with what Odubo Herrera was doing in center field. And, you know, he benched him for a few games. He talked about maybe moving him to left field or right field. But Matt Klentak mentioned something that when they signed him to the contract extension, that the analytics that are available publicly show this as well, that he actually graded out very well as a defensive center fielder last year. So while he might have the occasional lapse in judgment, he is pretty good. So Matt Klentak sounded like he is our center fielder going forward. Now, you know, if Roman Quinn comes on and at some point this season and plays great, possibly down the road they could switch Odubo to left field or right field. But for right now, it doesn't sound like there's any plans at all of moving him outside of center field. I think they want to keep him there. He's comfortable there. He's their best pure hitter, so I don't know if they want to mess with that necessarily. So there's a lot of reasons why I think, you know, he's pretty locked in center.
Yeah, and he certainly is for this year. That is for sure, if not going forward. Saunders will play right. What are the chances that that becomes or morphs into a platoon situation with Aaron Altherr in right field?
I think there's definitely a shot at that. You know, Aaron Altherr went into spring training last year as he's going to be the team's, I think he was going to be the left fielder, maybe Peter Borges in right. But he was going to be one of their everyday outfielders going into spring training last year. Then he had the wrist injury, missed most of the season, came back, I believe it was in early August, sometime in August. But he really, really struggled. So the Phillies aren't maybe as high on him as they were at this point last year. But with Michael Saunders in right, I think there is an opportunity for Aaron Altherr to get some at-bats. And the beautiful part about Aaron Altherr is he's very good defensively. So if they need to give Odubo Herrera a day off, Altherr can play in center field. If they want to give Howie Kendrick a day off, Altherr can play in left field. So I think there's actually going to be quite a few opportunities for him to play. Maybe not, obviously, as an everyday player, but anytime that one of those three guys needs a day off or there's a good matchup, I think you're going to see Aaron Altherr in there, and as long as he produces. And this is going to be a big opportunity for him. He has to produce certainly more than he did last year with the Phillies.
And then the other player impacted by the addition of Saunders is the guy you also mentioned, and that's Roman Quinn. And obviously, he's a guy that got a taste of the major leagues late last season, but he spent the whole year pretty much in Double-A. So it seems like there's still work to be done before he's ready to be a regular on this roster. But what are his chances heading into spring training of finding his way onto the opening day roster?
Honestly, I think the only opportunity he has or the best chance he has would be if somebody would get injured. In conversations I had before the Phillies signed Michael Saunders, I got the feeling that if they would get Saunders or Moss or Bruce or whomever, that they would bump Roman Quinn down to AAA because they are a high on him and they look at him as an everyday player. And because he has missed so much time over the years with injuries, I mean, he is always on the disabled list, it seems, having him on the big league roster as the fourth or fifth outfielder just doesn't make sense for them because they think that he needs more experience, more developmental time, and definitely more, which definitely means more plate appearances. So now with Saunders is there, if everybody stays healthy in spring training, I would be stunned, let me put it this way, if Roman Quinn made the big league roster. I think he's going to start the season in AAA. And if he can stay healthy and play well, then he can work his way up at some point because, you know, having Kendrick and Saunders on one-year contracts means the Phillies aren't necessarily committed to them. So if it's late in the season, the Phillies are out of it. You know, Roman Quinn's hitting over 300 with 60 stolen bases in AAA. You know, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't come up at some point and take over an everyday role.
And then he's with that core that he was with a year ago, too. That was a very talented Redding team in 2016, and you would think a lot of those guys will make their way up to start the year in Lehigh Valley in 2017. He'll be part of that. And there's some comfort there as well, especially when that team had so much success a year ago, to keep winning at the minor league level rather than maybe not be winning at the major league level.
Yeah, you know, it's a pretty interesting outfield in AAA this year, potentially, with Quinn. Nick Williams, who probably would have gotten called up late last season, except he struggled in August with the Iron Pigs. and then Dylan Cousins, who was one of their minor league players of the year. And that's a pretty talented minor league outfielder with a lot of potential. The Phillies remain high on, or are high on all three of those guys. So it'll be fun to kind of watch who really steps up this year and who might get a call up sooner rather than later. You know, last year I said Nick Williams is going to be the first Phillies prospect called up, and he didn't get called up at all, so what do I know? But if those guys play well eventually, you know, they're going to be back up. They're going to be up and trying to make a name for themselves with the Phillies.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see how Williams handles, you know, you talk about baseball and the failures and having to cope with the failures, and Nick Williams, a high prospect, and he had to deal with that in 2016. So this, is, I think, is a big season for him to see how he copes with it and bounces back. And certainly he's got all the tools to be a very good major league ball player. All right, it's going to be an interesting outfielder and outfield for the Phillies, and Saunders certainly adds some pop to that lineup and will make this team a little more interesting on the field in 2017. We'll continue around the roster again next week, but that's a look inside the Phillies outfield. For Todd Zielecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks for tuning in to MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.